Don't look now.
Welcome to Don't Look Now, the podcast with your hosts, Jenny McDonald and Will Hageman, coming to you every week on Tuesday with our podcast extraordinaire, having topics from all over the place, science, pseudoscience, the occult, cults, cats, coffee, whatever the case may be, whatever is kind of struck Jenny's fancy this week. As always, I got no idea what we're about to talk about. So I'm going to have Jenny give me some hints here as to what our topic is. So clue me in. What are we talking about this week?
Well, I watched Indiana Jones.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing for an archaeologist.
It's the new one. Have you seen the new one yet?
No, I have not. I have not seen it yet.
I was super disappointed, honestly, in a lot of ways. I had a really hard time paying attention, which...
That's not good.
Yeah, but honestly, that's kind of part of the course for a lot of shows these days.
Yeah.
But it reminded me of how much I love Indiana Jones.
Yeah. I mean, I was disappointed enough with Crystal Skull that I just wasn't chomping at the bit to go see the new one. So I was kind of waiting to find out whether I was going to be disappointed or not. So
Crystal Skull very much reminds me of the one in India.
Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much on that vibe of like weird, dark. This one was less of that and more of kind of the fighting with the Nazis and
swashbuckly type.
Yeah, it kind of leans back more to parts of the first one and the first part of Crystal Skull.
Okay.
There's just a lot of sadness in it. This does not have anything to do with what I'm talking about. I got off on a tangent.
That's all good.
Yeah, I brought this up because one of the Indiana Jones films, my personal favorite, is... No, the brain just broke. Not the first one, not the third one.
Oh, the Holy Grail one? The Last Crusade?
Yes, the Last Crusade. And it's so funny because media has really like, and I'm giving it away, it's the Crusades is what we're going to talk about because I have no intro for this, but like the media version of the Crusades is super interesting because it makes it seem like this just crazy noble story.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
When in reality, it's basically just a huge fucking failure.
Oh yeah, over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, it's massive.
Yeah, no, I knew little about it until actually fairly recently, because you just kind of got the general like, yeah, okay, there were crusaders that, you know, went to the Holy Land and conquered Jerusalem or whatever, and, you know, have a lot of problematic stuff associated with it or whatever, but I didn't know any details about it whatsoever. And then I've mentioned a million times going through this whole History of the Germans podcast, we got to the Holy Roman Empire and the various crusades and the massive failures of like every single time we're going to head out and march on down to the Holy Land and everybody's going to be dead before we ever get there. And it's just massive failure after massive failure. And you're just like, wow, I did not know that. So,
right. Especially because it seems like such a noble quest. You get even books that tell stories. They talk about like, oh, so-and-so's husband is off fighting in the Crusades. And, you know, it's this big, massive religious journey, and it makes it feel so different from what it really is, because like the ideal idea of it from Christianity's viewpoint was that they would go to the Holy Lands and just rid them of all of the Muslims that were, or the Moors that were living there at the time, right? So they just kept going to try to do this, and they have all these crusader states that are there along the eastern coast of the Mediterranean, but they're just not very good at fighting these people.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's a different tactic to fight people in Northern England than it is to fight people in the desert. And like, we just didn't catch on quickly.
Yeah. So each time it's kind of like they run out of food and water and basic things like that. And then the fighting sucks. So then, it's like terrible planning after terrible planning. And each time It seems like they have this, maybe you'll bring it up, but like whatever Prestigeon or whatever that they all think is going to show up and like with his forces from the east and rally to their cause. And this guy just doesn't even freaking exist. But each king is certain that he's coming to like aid them in their fight. And you're like, what the? Not a great strategy to depend on fake people from the east to come join you. But yeah. Good times.
Huh. Yeah. So the whole story of the Crusades is a long one. So I'm not going to go through all four Crusades. I'm only going to start with the first one today. My brain's slow. But here it is. I didn't let you guess anything, Will. I'm sorry. I'm terrible at this. So we know that the Crusades spanned more than two centuries. So it started around 1096 and went until 1300. And it was during the majority of the High Middle Ages. So essentially what they are these military expeditions initiated by the medieval papacy to seize the Holy Lands from Muslim control. So this idea being that it was the Christian church in the West that wanted control of everything, right?
Yep. And that's something that crops up a lot because it's definitively the Latin Christian church and not the Eastern Christian church.
Yes, exactly. But the thing that they aren't really saying that they're what they want the outcome to be is warfare. It just happens to be that's what happened. So prior to the 11th century, they did not wish to engage in this violent warfare. But there is a pretty dramatic shift in policy, and they try to start, or they denounce bloodshed in the beginning, and then they start to demand it in the name of God, which is kind of a weird political shift. It's especially a super fucking weird one, considering like one of the tenets of Christianity is to love thy neighbor, to suddenly want to murder thy neighbor, right?
Yeah, and I definitely learned some interesting stuff about why that. So, can talk about it, but I'll let you go through here. But yeah, I think the thing with love your neighbor, especially at the time, as long as your neighbor is Christian, and
right,
basically people were absolved as long as they were attacking non-Christians. And a lot of the people had run it out of people to loot locally that weren't Christian anymore because they'd actually spread it around enough that you had to go looking further afield to find non-Christians to plunder. And that's what led to a lot of it. But yeah, okay, anyway.
You know, they had nice things. The Christians yeah. wanted nice things. That's how it works. So the extended military raids stemmed from changes that took place outside of Europe before the age of the Crusades. So part of this is the growth and expansion of Islam. So the Christian holy wars bear a striking resemblance to the Muslim custom of jihad, which was pretty successful even then as an Islamic institution. And they translated the notion of that holy warrior into Christian terms. And they had the crusader, who was the knight for Christ, which is very appealing in the medieval period of time where people, you know, want to be courtly. They want to be a knight. They, you know, it gives them a good name. The Crusades, though, were more than just military exploits. They touched upon every aspect of life in the day. First and foremost, the popes who promoted the Crusades gained the authority to muster an army and send it on a mission. They never acquired, though, the actual power of like a field commander to oversee a battle or call for specific maneuvers, at least during the Crusades. The excursion into the armed forces, though, did a lot more damage than it did good, obviously, for the papacy. Yeah. And then by the last Crusade, a lot of people had come to see the Pope as just kind of another warmongering king, which, and they were just like over it. They did not view them kindly.
Yeah.
However, there was some benefit to medieval Europe. So the crusading allowed Westerners to take advantage of the richer East for the first time since the ancient days of Rome. It was an outlet for Europe's youth aggression as the population had exploded during the High Middle Ages. So like this is actually something that they bring up during the Vietnam War for the draft as a way to like justify sending men to war. It's kind of a continual theme. It's part of like propaganda for warmongering. is that, you know, we've got all these young, aggressive males that we need to send because the population has boomed. So we need to, you know, go get them to get this aggression out by killing people. So we send these young men off to fight in the holy wars, and it stifles some of the internal wars that they were experiencing since the collapse of the Roman government. And it forestalled the self-destruction that would characterize a lot of European history later down the line.
Yep.
The fact that a few of the Crusades were actually kind of victorious helped some of the European regions regain a sense of self-confidence, because they had centuries of losing. They just were not great fighters, which, once again, why, if you're not known for being good fighters, why are you going to start a war somewhere else, man?
It had some success. But yeah, you know, it was interesting, like the stuff that I was going through. Yeah, you know, relating to that, was you had all of these local squabbles all the time of your, you know, your local barons fighting each other all the time and murdering each other's peasants and doing whatever. And it's all juxtaposed with the fact that they're all super religious, but they're still doing, but then they're all know they're going to hell, because it's like, well, I'm going to hell because I murdered all these serfs, so I need a way out of this. And they're given the, all your sins are absolved if you go on crusade. So it's like, what I can do is I can fight with my neighbors and build my wealth and then go on crusade and absolve myself. And it kind of became this kind of system of, we do these things and we go on crusade, and then we tar ourselves again, and then we go on crusade. And yeah, it's pretty wild.
Yeah, it's kind of like a form of flagellants, right? Like, it's their way of cleaning their sins or something. It's insane.
Yep.
So yeah, it's mildly successful. The meager triumphs, you know, though, when you tally them up against casualties and mayhem, are they worth it? No, absolutely not. The crusading brought no significant new territories or any new allies to European cultural regions. It opened the door slightly for them to be able to do business abroad. But that was pretty harmful, because, you know, like, the church was terrible. And in the end, it was really more of a drain of energy and manpower. And we just increased all of our antagonistic, like, situations with all of our neighbors in the East. So this is not something that has gone away either. It has created a downstream effect that we are still seeing in 2023.
Yep.
Because we have now a history of being assholes to people. So for the people living in the Near East during this period, the results of these invasions were very similar to how we would view, like, Viking raids. And this is, like I said, it still is a very negative, like, viewpoint that the Islamic world has on Europeans. And to them, of course, they're totally negative. There's no benefit. So you have highly civilized, very peaceful states here, and then the Crusaders come in and they maraud everything, kill people, destroy shit, and then, like, that is the impression that they're leaving and on their Muslim neighbors that they've invaded. They're like, no, these people are terrible. Do you know what they'll do?
Like, yeah.
They're kind of the boogeyman. So there's really not any benefit for anybody. It's just a mess. There is other ways to look at the Crusades. You don't really look at the origins and the causes, because that's the way a lot of, like, historians want to look at it. Instead, it's like, looking at the future, we can see them not as a consequence, but as a cause. So, like, they're more significant than the failed attacks in the Near East. What we did was we learned how to migrate and conquer, which is not something that we really needed to learn how to do as European, like, people. They proved unsuccessful for expansion, however, because they couldn't really hold on to what they had over time. Although I think that's really more the Europe's trend anyway. They go into places and they colonize, and then they don't stick around forever. Like, the colonies kind of collapse over time. Yeah. I'm not saying that the civilization where they were collapses, just like the relations break down over time. Although I think... Does England still have a pretty good presence in India?
Obviously they had to give up control of India, but there's still, I think, there's still a whole lot of English culture there.
Yeah. I mean, that's just like one example of another 100 years later, how years later, we're still doing the same pattern as the Crusades and not really doing much and then abandoning post over time.
Yeah. It's because most of these things aren't, you know, people are attacking or whatever, but they don't really want to hold the territory. It's not like they really want to add that piece of land to France or something like
Right.
that. Like you go with like Alsace or something like that, like, you know, your nice little German French squabble, and they'll fight and occupy that forever. And that will go back and forth because it's next door and they really care about it. But, you know, other places they'll move in, they'll do stuff. But in the end, it's like, yeah, that's not. It's not France, it's not Germany, it's not England, it's some other place, and they're willing to leave. And yeah, it's just a different attitude, I guess. But
it's easier to maintain and hold on to control of contiguous land than it is non-contiguous, because like they're 200 miles away, they'll just do whatever the hell they want, which is I think where a lot of the problems run into, right? Is that they are not close enough to their subjects, that the subjects are benefiting from being a colony of the main country.
Yeah, and they're also, and also continuing to push the narrative of you're not really the home country.
Right.
You're not part of us. You're this other place that you're affiliated, and we want to control you, but you're not us. And
right.
You know,
you're the redheaded stepchildren of the situation. Yeah.
Yeah. And that always ends up spilling over.
I mean, of course it does. So yeah, they sometimes call the Crusades the Lost Weekend. So they equate them to a drunken binge from which you wake up having only vague memories of what happened and with whom because of how ridiculous the Crusades were. And I think this is my favorite analogy for a period of time. Yeah, it's a drunken binge. It's a lost weekend, you know? So yeah, the spark that sets off the Crusades is struck not in Europe, but in the East. It's when the Byzantians first confronted a new Muslim force, the Seljuk Turks. Originally, they were an Asian horde, which, like the Huns of earlier times, had penetrated far into the West. The Seljuk Turks controlled a lot of the Near East by the 11th century. And with Persia in their grip, including Baghdad, the capital of the Muslim world, they had converted to Islam en masse and presented a really terrifying prospect of Muslim Huns or Mongol jihadists. So the Byzantians were pretty concerned because that's a pretty aggressive conquering method as well. And then worry turns quickly into panic when the Turkish forces begin expanding into the Eastern Asia Minor. And there's a meeting of the Turks at the Battle of Manzikert in 1071 CE. The Byzantians were badly defeated and stood on the verge of losing the whole of Asia Minor to the Turkish onslaught. So they start asking for help. Nobody nearby is willing to assist them. So the last resort is, what if we call those people in England that we talked to that one time? Hey, remember that one time we met like 17 years ago? Do you want to have dinner next week? Their version of the MLMs, right? So Christian pilgrims on their way to Jerusalem. I don't know where I was going with that. So ever since the Justinian Gothic Wars and the Byzantium's subsequent failures to impose iconoclasm in the West, Byzantium and Western Europe had long suffered strained relations. And it seems a little odd that they would reach out to them for assistance because they had reached a fever pitch by the middle of the 11th century and splintered into separate sects. So you have the Catholic Church in Rome and Eastern Orthodox in Constantinople. By the time of the Crusades, the Christian Church of Western Europe pretty much belonged to a whole different religion from those in the Eastern Orthodox Church. So to reopen the channels of communication between these former friends, we have to think about the fact they don't speak the same language anymore. They haven't done anything together for centuries. And they're like, what do we do? Because this is the only option. So the situation also had a minor but immediate impact on the West as well. We have a few direct contacts between the Muslims and Europeans, and they're largely the result of Christian pilgrims going through to Jerusalem and the Holy Lands. Prior to the Turkish takeover, Muslims had not actively prevented their right to coming and going. Muslims in the day would have probably laughed a little bit, actually, at these white-ass people going on these pilgrimages. They were mostly harmless, and saw them as pretty, like, misguided. They viewed them as children who were imitating adults, and they attempt to incorporate them into the Hajj. They're like, you know, it makes much more sense because this religion is bullshit for you to do the Hajj. Very similar pilgrimages, both going to Holy Lands. We're talking about the same Holy Lands in a lot of times, just with different names, because we sure do love to incorporate the local religion in everybody's religion. That's just how it works. But anyhow, as the Byzantine Turkish antagonism gets worse in the 11th century, it starts to get worse for pilgrims to go on pilgrimages, or really anybody. It gets really difficult just to go through Asia Minor. It gets really, really, really unsafe. So looking for ways to leverage military assistance from the West, the Byzantine Emperor Alexis, I really like that word, Byzantine. I know what's wrong. I don't even care. It just feels good to say. The Emperor Alexis Comnenus used this conflict with the Turks and its impact on the pilgrimages and tourism as a basis of appeal. He used capitalism as a basis for why we should all get together and work together. That's some stuff right there, man. So he writes the church in Rome, and he sends out a bunch of propaganda, like a bunch of propaganda, saying things like the Turkish have committed all of these atrocities against these pilgrims in Asia Minor. And then he's like, you know what? I know a good way to fix this problem. What if we combined the church in Constantinople with the church in Rome again? Wouldn't that be cool? So this sounded like an intriguing idea because, you know, the Pope looks at this. It's Pope Urban II. And he's like, wow, we could help our allies and our fellow Christians in the East. What if we have a holy war? Pretty radical shift in Eastern doctrine at the time. And it's going to be a big deal, right? Like, let's throw together this holy war. Let's make this happen. There was a program of measures put together. And the idea was that they don't want fighting in Europe, if possible. And there should be no fighting on holidays or the weekend. Like, they attempted to write down the rules of warfare, expecting that everybody was going to play the same game.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that worked well?
Of course it did. That's why we only fight during the week these days, and wars have not happened on weekends ever since.
Definitely haven't had to call Christmas truces or anything like that.
Yep.
So the truce of God is what this is called. It's a pretty, you know, direct, extensive policy. And it's remodeled into a declaration ending all wars in which Christians fight Christians. So this then creates a perceived threat, which is the Muslim infidels in the East. So now we have this ideology that the Crusades were a peace movement to withhold peace in Christianity and to fight the infidels, right?
Yep.
Needless to say, it took some reworking of the New Testament to make this work for them. On the surface, war is hardly the preferred vehicle of peace, but in those days, the Pope had the advantage of being one of the few who could read, much less, you know, reread anything. So yeah, we have this now army, and we have given the knights of this army a holy vocation, calling them vessels of Christ. Urban II is granting anyone who joins the crusade automatic indulgence. Namely, he forgives all prior sins. So just like you were saying, they were these feudal lords who were killing each other. And he's just like, no, no, no. You don't have to pay penance for murder. This could be your salvation as long as you're killing the right person. So like, you want to kill people, buddy? I have people for you to kill. Come sign up with me.
You want to kill and plunder and get forgiven while you're at it? Go for it. Yeah.
Everybody wonders why we didn't hear about like serial killers during this period of time. This is why things like this happen, right?
Yeah, things for them to be doing.
Yeah, they kept them busy and like indulged their murderous tendencies. And of course, like Europeans are hearing all of this. They get these stories told to them and they make it just absolutely fascinating for them. So Pope Urban starts to notice, like, everybody is really listening to all this propaganda. They're all telling each other the same, like, terrible 10 stories. So then he takes his marketing campaign on the road, and he starts to go in front of, like, French knights, and he is telling them these stories about the land of milk and honey and how they need to avenge these Turkish atrocities perpetuated against fellow Christians. And then he starts to cite the propaganda sent to him by Alexis Comnenus and, like, gets them to fight by saying things like, for the remission of your sins, you'll be met with the assurances of imperishable glory. And, you know, then they would say things like, kill the Muslims indiscriminately, which, I'm sorry, sounds a little terrible. Like, they didn't care what you were doing. They just, yeah, it's just terrible. And the crowd would shout back things like, God wills it. So, like, they had people pretty fucking convinced this was a good life choice.
Yep.
So, it's pretty clear, though, from a lot of tellings, that there's more than religious frenzy at work here. The Crusades reflect on other aspects of life in Europe at the time, especially, like, we have a population boom. It's one of the most significant features of the High Middle Ages. So, we had the Viking invasions had, like, stopped at the turn of this millennium. And they had kind of a calm period of time. As someone who has lived through like 10 wars, I would like to know what that's like. Let's not start a war for a hot minute.
Be nice.
Right?
Been a while.
Yeah. So when you're not fighting in wars every single day, populations tend to boom because wars are a great way to maintain populations. So we've got a century later, the Crusades are happening. We've got a crap ton of people in Europe. And we're trying to figure out what we're going to do, like I said, with all of these young men, because we can replenish our warriors. That's not the issue. But the problem is that with this population boom, you have a lot of sons that will not be able to inherit or have a livelihood. So the money just don't go that far. So people need some purpose and direction. So this is a nice way to funnel that energy. It's not a nice way. There's nothing as nice about warfare. And then, of course, you have your political forces at work. So we've got the Crusades tied to the investiture controversy, which is the struggle for power between the rising authority of the Pope and the ruling political system in the day. So from the Pope's side, the kings of Europe had long intruded upon the sacred rights of the Pope to run his business, which is basically like, he thinks he should be running all the show. And of course, the kings think the opposite, that they should be running their show.
Yep.
There's always been a very odd unease between the church and monarchies. Man, words are hard to find tonight. So yeah. So in calling the First Crusade, Urban II shifted the theater of action in the political conflict to an arena where medieval kings had traditionally reigned supreme, the battlefield. So he starts to usurp the most secular rulers and claim, and their claims traditionally, to declare the enemy and muster troops for battle. Worsened yet, because they reinterpreted the truce of God as a warrant for Europeans to kill Muslims and not each other, he also is embarrassing secular leaders for all their inter-European wars, which now look really unchristian because they were fighting brother versus this fight against the enemy, right?
Yep.
And we know prior to that, the church sanctioned this shit. This was just their new political spin. So they use this spin to get things rolling. All their underlying causes, the major motivation during the Crusades, both on the surface and beneath it, was religious sentiment. And it was bordering on like religious hysteria. A majority of Christians in Europe saw this call to arms as a mean to salvation and a way of ridding the world of infidels. To them, referred not only to the Muslims, but also Jews of Europe, many who were slaughtered before the Knights of the Crusade rolled out in search of the Holy Land, because you couldn't send your men off to fight one infidel and abandon the homeland to another. So the idea being like, kill all the bad people on the way. And we just gave them carte blanche, right? Like, as long as they aren't Christian, do your business. So yeah, that's what they did. They head out, they kill everybody along the way that is not a Christian, and the crusade starts basically a tide of blood, and just keeps getting worse. So we start to have the Christian knights assemble from all over Europe and move toward Constantinople around 1096. The Byzantines were horrified to see these hordes of Western Europeans knocking on their doors, which I think is great because hordes were also used to describe people coming from the East.
Yep.
So like the fact that they didn't really distinguish that they were European hordes versus just hordes is fabulous. And part of the problem with this is that, like, the reason they're so horrified is because most of the crusaders were dirt poor and super poorly armed. So, like, who the hell did you send us? You basically sent us your homeless community. This is not going to help us. They're poor, they're sick, and they can barely stand up. So they're a little frustrated because Alexis Comnenus was like, I didn't ask the Pope for a bunch of indigent desperados, but I did ask for skilled fighters who could help me repel the Turks. So, like, how the hell are we going to fight this army with these poor sick kids you sent us, essentially? So the lowest estimate of the Crusaders' force is around 25,000 bodies. Most likely there were up to 100,000. And as far as the Byzantians were concerned, it was, like I said, a throng of poorly clothed, raggedy-fleshed, stick-holding Europeans that showed up to fight a fight that they weren't ready to fight. The Crusaders' aims corresponded little with those of the Byzantians who were seeking to stem the tide of Turkish aggression. The Europeans, on the other hand, have now been fed all this propaganda. So they were more excited about this idealized fantasy of liberating Jerusalem and the Holy Lands from Muslim oppression. And so, like, the Byzantians couldn't communicate with them because it's very difficult to deal with fanatics when you're like, no, we just have an issue with these 12 people over here. And they're like, no, we're taking back the Holy Land. We're on a crusade. Mm-hmm. We're the warriors of God. It's hard. So you've got crusaders and they're a mess. So the Byzantians acted in a fashion typical to Easterners from, you know, the perspective of the Westerners. After a long-standing policy of baffling, stalling, and deceiving, Alexis Comnenus greets the crusaders. He's a little cold, but he has some reasonable hospitality. And he escorts them through his kingdom and beyond to the eastern borders of the Byzantine Empire, vowing that, you know, more military and financial support would follow. As soon as they're gone, though, he's like, shut the damn doors. We are not. Lock the gate. Do not let them back in. They are on their own. Are you fucking kidding me? We are not helping these people. They're actually not going to be helpful for us either. And he was like, the Turkish they're going to decimate this group of people in no time flat. I don't think this is a good idea. Just leave them. They'll be dealt with eventually and we'll be off of this, right? However, the crusaders were guided by fanaticism. Fanatics are much more likely to succeed than someone who is not. I mean, there's blind faith will get you pretty far in this life, apparently.
Yeah, especially in battle when it all comes down to, do you break and run or do you not? And, you know.
Right. And if you think God's leading you, yeah, you're not going to break and run. So they held on and did better than anticipated. Many of them survived this betrayal, which then word gets back to Europe that Alexis Comnenus had not followed through. And now he's on the shit list for Europe, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what he underestimated was that he had a bunch of poor people who were fanatics. The thing about poor people is they don't need a lot to survive. So they were used to not having a lot of food. They were used to not having any comfort. They just were drawn by their religious convictions and went a hell of a lot further than anybody expected. They made it all the way to Syria and captured the city of Antioch in 1098, which was a big damn shocker for Alexis Comnenus, who wasn't anticipating they would survive the night, let alone to take over a city. So the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, no, that's not happening. So it's a long and arduous siege, and they do eventually get Antioch, which is where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, nope, that's in Jerusalem. That's in Jerusalem. It's not in Antioch. I don't know why I keep trying to say it's there. It's not. Antioch was a long, arduous siege, and the victory gave new life to their cause, and so then they continue south. This is when they go into the Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
I knew we'd get there eventually. And they besiege Jerusalem in 1099, and that's when they take it over. And they're instrumental in the success. Instrumental in that success was a brutality that was pretty astonishing. They were pretty ruthless and bloody. And they equated them to a lot of Viking tendencies with their bloodiness, which a lot of them were of Viking lineage because they came from Northern Europeans. So it made sense that they acted in the way of the Vikings, right? So they treated the defeated as no better than animals. They ravaged whole populations. After they captured Antioch, they exterminated all the Turks there. They sacked Jerusalem, and they start boasting about how savage they are. You know, they tell these stories about we rode in the blood of the infidels and up to our knees in blood. It's a little horrific. And they have no basic human decency. So it's pretty disgusting. A non-Christian crusader who witnessed their cruelty writes, "If you had been there, you would have seen that our feet colored our ankles with the blood of the slain. What more should I say to relate? None of our people were left alive. None of the women or children or anything. And once they were done, they went to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre of the Lord to pray." And remember, they've been given carte blanche by the church that as long as they're not Christian, do it and you're forgiven. I can't even imagine. So worse yet, they don't have any interest in settling the lands. So like, remember when we talk about colonizing, that's the issue, is that you got to hold on to these lands. You can't just conquer and hope for the best. So we have Jerusalem now in the security of Christian hands. Most of the Western assailants decide, let's go home. It's time. They come home. They're seen as heroes. A handful of them stay and set up Christian-run governments, and the four so-called crusader states. These are the ones that are along the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. Mm-hmm. Here they're building European-style castles called crafts. And I would anticipate that a lot of the reason why they're staying is because they didn't actually have anything to go home to. Because remember, these are like the extra kids.
Yep.
These are the spares, not the heirs. So they've got to figure out what they're doing with their life, which is like one of the most horrific ways to talk about your children, but whatever. And apparently you can still see some of these castles. They're crumbling and they look super out of place because they look like European and French castles in Syria.
Yeah.
Be interesting to see. So let's go down a rabbit hole. Because this is the end of the First Crusade and there's three more. and I don't have the energy for three more.
Nope.
But what I do have the energy for is to talk about Elizabethan food. Seems like a perfect correlation, right? Well,
yeah.
I actually really love European Elizabethan food culture. It's one of the most fascinating periods of time in food because they just were obsessed with food. And it had a lot to do with your social class. There were just a lot of rules associated with Elizabethan food. There's this whole TV show, and my God, if I could get it, I think it's on ITV or something. It's called Lords and Ladles. And they go to manors in Scotland and England, and they have actual records of Elizabethan dinners that they try to recreate. It's fucking fabulous. At one of the manors, they used to weigh the guests before they ate, and then again after they ate to ensure that they ate properly. I'd be fucking furious if they did that, but also, right? Okay. So, food varies in Elizabethan England according to your social class. The Elizabethans ate three meals a day, breakfast, dinner, and supper. Breakfast would be eaten as early as 6 a.m., dinner was consumed at midday, and supper was between 5 and 8 p.m. You're feeding me at 8 p.m., and I'm going to be taking a nap or not eating. I'm just putting that out there. Elizabethans, it was really important. The presentation was like 90% of the meal, especially for feasts. So they went all out decorating their meals. Feasts were a great way to show off your wealth. So you have things like peacocks that were raised for the whole point was the consumption of the peacock. And then they would use the feathers to decorate the finished food. This is when we start to get into aspics, which have, you know what an aspic is, Will?
Like a jelly.
Yeah. It's the meat jelly.
Bakery jelly. Yeah, it's yeah. Bone jelly stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's essentially like, if you boil some meats, there's a weird jelly fat that comes. So like pot roast is a great example. When you cook it, there's a layer of fat and then there's a layer of jelly. This is jelly. And then they would put things in the jelly to decorate it. So like eggs, quail eggs were especially popular. They're boiled. This hit big in the 70s because they were putting like hot dogs in aspics. I mean, aspic is disgusting. It has no flavor. It's just gelatin. It's weird. So then the major difference between the meals consumed by the wealthy and the poor were that the wealthy ate a lot more meat. The wealthy consumed so much meat and in such large quantities that they actually created a lot of stomach problems as a result of it because too much protein and the works don't work. You need more fiber in there. And the kinds of meat they were eating were just like we would eat today. So beef, veal, pork, lamb, mutton, chicken, duck, goose, pigeon. They even ate some game, whatever was available, really. Cheese was also something important that they ate, along with nuts, walnuts, and chestnuts. Desserts would be things like fruit, honey, pastries, pudding, biscuits, gingerbread, cakes, and tarts. Did I mention a single goddamn vegetable in there?
Not yet.
No vegetables. So essentially, they're eating a lot of protein and a lot of sugar. And they love sugar. And refined sugar is really important because it's imported from the Americas. So it's super expensive. And they make marzipans and jams and other sweets. And they would eat so much sugar. And this is a sign of wealth during this period of time that their teeth turn black.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such a status symbol to have black teeth to show how much money you're worth that people started blackening their teeth on purpose so that they looked wealthier. And it's funny because now that's not a sign of wealth, right?
Yeah.
During special occasions, they would serve as much meat as they could in different ways. And guests would be asked for a sample before choosing a dish of their choice. So I imagine this very much like the Brazilian barbecue places that I've never been to that I would absolutely go to, where they would come by and just like chuck off a little bit. Here, have some chicken to try. Do you like the chicken? Would you like some more? Yeah. And the food was really flavorful, especially the game, because to make game taste acceptable, mutton especially has a really strong taste. You add a lot of spices, and spice is another way to show your wealth. So there's a lot of cloves and pepper and saffron and nutmeg. And my God, if we could afford saffron in this day and age. Cooked with a lot of vinegar, fennel, and salt. And then they started adding flowers, because flowers like violets and marigolds give a pretty distinct flavor. But meat and fish were frequently cooked in ale, because it breaks it down really nicely and gives food really good flavor. So we know that that's what the rich ate. What the poor eat, though? So they ate whatever they could find. So they're more likely to eat small game like rabbits, hens, pigeon, and fish. But meat was really only for special occasions. They mostly ate cheese, bread, milk, porridge, and fruit. They're getting their fiber in from that porridge, though. That stuff is hard on your digestive tract.
I'm start living on turnips.
Right. Actually, turnips are delicious. I like a good turnip. And we know that there's a class system within poverty, because there were different levels of bread that you would eat. So the poorest ate the cheapest bread available, which is a dark brown bread, which is a mixture of rye and wheat. The middle class consumed ravel, which is known as yeoman's bread, which is made out of wholemeal. And then the wealthiest ate white flour bread or manchette. So, go ahead.
That inverse healthiness,
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Everything we know now. But I bet that white bread tasted damn good, right?
Yep.
So here are the veggies that they would have eaten during this period. Turnips, which are delicious. I maintain this. Parsnips, carrots. That
was terrifying. So gross.
So good. They ate some lettuce, some peas, some cabbage, some onions, leeks, radishes, and garlic. It's really interesting because most of these are winter vegetables. They're not really like summer veggies. I guess you could say the peas are, but most of the other ones aren't.
It's a whole lot of root vegetables.
Whole lot of root veggies, yeah. And then in the 1580s, Sir Walter Raleigh brings in potatoes, and those are considered a real delicacy. Now, fruit, on the other hand, they ate cherries, lemons, raspberries, blackberries, melons, and strawberries. And if you were very wealthy, you would eat things like pomegranates and peaches. Although, like, we have fruit and people eat the fruit, you very seldom would eat it raw. It's usually baked into a pie or boiled into a jam to make it sweeter. So that's great. And finally, what did we drink? Sure as hell didn't drink the water. I'll put that out there. Drinking water was unsafe, so they drank ale. And it was a pretty weak ale, and a stronger one would be reserved for festive occasions. Occasionally, they would drink beer. And part of that is beer is pretty cheap, and it could be stored for a really long time before it would go bad. Wines were pretty expensive, so they would be imported from like Greece or France or Madeira. As a result, it was drunk only on formal occasions and mostly by the rich. And milk was sometimes drank, but usually only by children or old people. So that is the story.
Nice.
With random extra story.
That sounds good. But interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, cool. Well, thanks for everything. It's always fascinating to hear about a lot of that, because it's just part of the ingrained culture that everybody hears. People talk about crusades all the time, but nobody actually knows anything about them most of the time. So,
right.
Yeah. So, yeah, good to hear. But, well, yeah, thanks for the topic, and thank you, everybody, for listening to us this week. As always, rate, review, subscribe. Tell your friends about our podcast. We'll see you all in a week. Bye, folks.
Bye.